Hello, everybody, and welcome to the newest, latest, and greatest episode. Episode 4? Episode 3? I don't know. Let me check that real quick. Episode 3. Episode 3 of the Vet Nerd Game Dive. Game Dives of a Nerdy Vet, however you want to say it. Thanks again for coming in, listening, and tuning in for another episode. My name is Ron, and of course you can always find us at our Facebook and Instagram at The Noasis, Twitter at The Noasis 1, and now on Snapchat at The Noasis. And wherever you're listening to this podcast, you can also get it on Anchor FM, Spotify, Radio Breaker, Pocket Cast, and numerous other ones. So thanks for stopping in. And let's go ahead and get to it. So for our first headline of Section 1 for our news review, this one's brought to you by the National Law Review. Loot Box or Pandora's Box? Regulation of treasure chests in video games. This was by the National NatLawReview.com, the National Law Review, and one form of digital promotion that has recently drawn attention across several states and countries is the sale of treasure chests or loot boxes in video games and apps. Loot boxes typically offer players a chance-based opportunity to obtain virtual items for use in a game. These in-game items may help improve a player's chances of success in the game, or they may merely be a decorative and simply give a player bragging rights based on rarity. Although the items found in loot boxes often are available by grinding or continuing to play the game over time, buying a loot box gives a player a chance to obtain the same item faster. In short, it can be a trade-off of time versus money, though without a guarantee of what is in any given loot box. Loot boxes also may give a player that psychological excitement and stimulation of feeling like the player has won something, regardless whether the thing has any real-world value or utility outside the virtual world of the game. It is largely based on these psychological factors that some jurisdictions have begun to take the position that the selling of loot boxes may constitute a form of gambling, or at least warrant some form of regulation. Even in the absence of prizes with real-world value being available in the loot boxes, such real-world value prizes generally being a threshold requirement for a finding of illegal gambling under most existing U.S. precedents at this time. Outside the United States, a few countries have publicly addressed loot boxes. Below is a summary of some of those countries' public positions. The positions vary. Some deem the sale of loot boxes a form of gambling. Others stop short of that conclusion, but nonetheless require certain disclosures when offering loot boxes. Yet others have gotten comfortable with the sale of loot boxes, at least when the items available to be won are purely virtual rewards with no real-world value. In Australia, the Office of eSafety has expressed concern that loot boxes may be a gateway to a later addictive gambling behavior, and the state of Victoria stated that loot boxes are a form of gambling. In Belgium, the Gaming Commission has stated that loot boxes are, quote, games of chance subject to gambling laws. Japan, the National Consumer Affairs Agency, issued an opinion that virtual items and paid loot boxes could be considered, quote, prizes, where players find the items to be strongly desirable even without any demonstrable real-world monetary value. In the Netherlands, the Gaming Authority issued a report that games with paid loot boxes and the ability to transfer items are illegal under gambling laws. In China, game companies must disclose odds for paid loot boxes. Some companies have avoided this requirement by selling other items, such as in-game currency, and pairing those items with free loot boxes. Ooh, nice little play on words there. In South Korea, the Fair Trade Commission fined video game companies nearly $900,000 in 2018 for misstating odds related to loot boxes. In April 2019, it requested information from video game developers regarding in-game purchases, particularly related to underage users. The UK and New Zealand, the gambling commissions have stated that loot boxes offering purely virtual rewards are not gambling, presumably with no authorized secondary market. And France took a somewhat similar approach to the UK and New Zealand in its 2017-18 report, although it seemed to suggest that loot boxes may not be in line with the public policy on gambling. In the United States, however, several states, California, Hawaii, Indiana, Minnesota, New York, and Washington, have considered legislation related to loot boxes. Most of the state bills would require various types of disclosure and/or limit sales to persons over 18. However, none of the states have yet passed legislation to require disclosures or limit sales. At the federal level, Senator John Hawley, Republican from Missouri, introduced the Protecting Children from Abusing Games Act in May 2019, the bill would ban loot boxes and microtransactions in games specifically targeted at children, as well as games for which the game developer has a constructive knowledge that users are minors. Although the bill has bipartisan support, it is not clear whether it will proceed to further consideration, as the FTC has announced its intent to hold a workshop on August 7, 2019 to consider consumer protection issues related to loot boxes and microtransactions. Public comments may be submitted online through October 11, 2019 at 11:15 p.m. Eastern. Requirements for the apps. Separate from any legal requirements, as of December 2017, Apple has addressed loot boxes in its App Store review guidelines, where it requires app developers to disclose the odds of obtaining each type of virtual item in a loot box. In 2019, Google adopted the same disclosure requirement in its Google Play developer policy. So, gamers, I'm kind of on the fence about this, honestly. I really am, because there's a part of me that absolutely hates loot boxes. But then there's another part of me that understands that loot boxes are the monster that we created. Price of games has been the same for, 15, 20 years now? It's always been $60. However, cost of goods and all that has gone up considerably in those same 20 years. So why hasn't the price inflated with the market? And to that I say, that's mostly because of us, because the video game developers, publishers, producers, so on and so forth, they know that they would not be able to sell anything if they went any higher than $60. We just wouldn't buy it, and they know that, you know. I mean, but the prices to make those games keep rising every year, you know. I mean, you're starting to look at the big budget AAA titles starting to use almost as much money as the as the AAA movies. Millions and millions of dollars are being put into the video game industry to make one game, but yet we're still only paying $60 for it. So their hand was kind of forced. They had to do something to start recouping that money, to start coming up with ways to make that money back, because $60, you know, you're making pennies on the dollar at that. Now, has there been some people that have used loot boxes the wrong way? 100% there is. We all remember that EA fiasco with Star Wars Battlefront. Pay to win should not be a thing, especially in competitive multiplayer. It should not be a thing where whoever throws the most money at the game is going to be the winner. And that's what EA was doing with their Battlefield loot boxes. And customers spoke, gamers spoke around the world, and they quit giving EA all that money. And then eventually, you know, everything played out the right way, and EA backtracked and said, okay, we're not going to do it this way. So, like I said, I'm on the fence about it. I don't mind paying for loot boxes for, you know, aesthetic versions, different costumes, different skins and stuff. I don't mind paying for the bragging rights. I do mind paying for the game. I already gave you the $60, like I said, and enough is enough. But, like I said, I have to agree with them that they're going to have to make their money somewhere, and this is one of the first places that they found it. Do I consider it gambling? Nah, not really. I mean, for the pay-to-win loot-style boxes, yeah, it is a form of gambling, I would think. But, man, I don't know. That's a tough one. The more I think about it, the more I'm not really sure. Yeah, that's something that I would have to think more on. But I will tell you where this is really bad, and it's in the mobile gaming. Cell phone games are absolutely notorious for the pay-to-win loot boxes. Candy Crush, Cooking Frenzy, you name it. And they have toned it back a lot more, please don't get me twisted. But it is still there, where the only way that you're going to get through that frustratingly hard level is you're going to have to throw down 99 cents here, $1.99 there, you know, so on and so forth. So, I don't know. There are going to be some changes coming, and I don't know how much of it we are going to like. The next article that popped up for me, I found really interesting. It's the 40 best PS4 games as of right now in 2019. And it looks like this goes all across the entire life cycle of the PlayStation 4. So this isn't the top 40 games of just 2019 or of just 2018. This is the top 40 games of PS4 of all time. And there were some on this list that I didn't particularly agree with. There was some that I agreed with wholeheartedly. There was even some that I had never even heard of. There's some of these games that I have yet to hear of, but it has piqued my interest to the point where I would want to play. So this article was actually done by PopularMechanics.com. So I won't read through all 40, but you can find the article on PopularMechanics.com. The title of the game, or of the article, I'm sorry, is The 40 Best PlayStation 4 Games, and it's by Brittany Vincent on PopularMechanics.com. Number one was Ace Combat 7 Skies Unknown. Ace Combat has always been around, and it's always been a really solid game. Is it number one? I can't make a fair judgment. I didn't play it, but I have heard nothing but good reviews on it. So, Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag. You can never go wrong with the Assassin's Creed franchise. There's a lot of kids out there that they know some of their history because they played Assassin's Creed. Number three is Battlefield 1. I sunk so many hours into this game, it was unreal. I ended up getting really good, and then I fell out, and then I jumped back in, and I just had so many different maps that I had to try to relearn that I was so far behind the pace that I ended up getting discouraged. But all in all, the story mode was really good. I loved the unique take they had on the campaign, the single player campaign. And I like how they went back to using the currency system to unlock stuff instead of, getting promoted and unlocking stuff that way. So it's still, you know, with the currency based unlock system, it gives everybody a fair shot at being on an equal playground. Number four is Bloodborne. Bloodborne has always been a signature franchise of the PS4. It's a PlayStation exclusive, and it's just one of the ones that Sony fans can really hang their hat on as to why, you know, they chose the PS4 over the Xbox. Bloodstained, Ritual of the Night. I haven't played this one. This is one of those ones that I've never even heard of. So, listeners, if you have an opinion or an input about this game, or if you think I really need to play it, go ahead and shoot me a message and let me know, dude, you're really missing out on this. I love finding new games. So, to me, it kind of looks like a JRPG. But then at the same time, you know, it says in the description that it is a 2D platformer. And there are tons of weapons, armor, and items to collect, and a whole castle to explore. Ritual of the Night channels the best parts of Symphony of the Night and adds enough modern tweaks to propel it beyond its inspiration. So that's number five. Number six, Call of Duty World War II. Not really going to go into that. Anybody and their mother who's been around for the last 5 years knows what a Call of Duty game is. They haven't changed. About the only highlight of the Call of Duty game is the prop hunt. I love watching the videos on that. I love trying to play it, so... Detroit Become Human. This game made quite the splash when it came out. It's a decision-based game, you know, where you're just following the storyline and you make decisions as you go. It was... Man. It was just an outstanding game. The graphics were beautiful. The script was beautifully written. It puts a lot... It's one of those games where you experience just as much as you play because of the amount of thought that you have to put into the game. So I definitely agree with this being on the top 10 list. Devil May Cry 5. Devil May Cry 5, it is one of the best entries in the series. It's beautiful to look at. It's challenging, but at the same time, it's not so challenging that it discourages you and you put it away never to look at it again for the next 6 months. I think this game deserves to be on the list too. Doom. Yeah. I think Doom should have been higher on the list. Higher than number 9 for the top 10 or the top 40. It should have been higher than number 9. When they remade this game, they absolutely hit a grand slam with it. It was done so beautifully, and it really, really brought that franchise back. The one for PC, was it Doom 2006? Had to have been, because I was still in high school. Yeah, the Doom 2006, it was good, but it focused more on the horror, which Doom has the potential to be a horror game, for sure. When I played it for the PC and the Sega Genesis, you know, 9-year-old me did have nightmares, but you know, for the normal teenager to young adult to adult player, it's not really a horror game. And the Doom 2006, they did an awesome job of giving you those jump scares and giving you that horror feel. But Doom at its core is a shooter. I mean, it is the father of first person shooting. And the way they did it with the Doom 26, you know, with this new Doom for the PS4, I mean, fast-paced, always moving. Like, if you sit still for longer than 5 seconds, you're going to die, and that's just the way it is. And I love that, and I cannot wait for Doom Eternal to come out later this year. Lastly, the top 10 out of the 40, Dragon Quest XI, Echoes of an Elusive Age. Again, this is another game. I've heard of it, but I've never played it. The writer of this article goes, sometimes a game doesn't have to be particularly innovative to be good. Dragon Quest XI doesn't have any new tricks up its sleeve. Instead, it refines the JRPG formula to its best components and pulls them off wonderfully. The turn-based combat, mysterious hero story feel delightfully retro, but there's enough modern convenience packed in to make it still feel fresh. In a time when long-running franchises are trying, sometimes too hard, to stay relevant, Dragon Quest XI is fine with being reliable and well-built, which ironically makes it unique. And with that ends it now for the news section, and we are going to go on to something that's fresh in my mind, but deep in my heart, and that is the God of War series. I'm going to do a little bit better on the news, guys. I understand the news is lacking with some real hard-hitting headlines. I'll start getting more into that. I'll start doing my part and getting more research done, but for now, just chill out with me for 30 seconds while we listen to this ad, and we will get into the history of the God of War franchise. Welcome back. Thanks for keeping up with me, and thanks for coming back from that ad. This week, as I said, something that I'm really excited about. For video game history, we are going to be looking at the God of War franchise. Now, the God of War has been around since PlayStation 2, and it's been on every Sony platform since then, and even one that is not a Sony platform. So, let's go ahead and get to it, nerds. God of War is about a very angry, very, very, very angry, very vengeful Spartan by the name of Kratos. He spots a snow, or a grayish white skin. And he has the red tattoos going all up and down his body. He wields what are called the Blades of Chaos, and that are hooked to chains, and the chains are infused and seared into his forearms. We'll get into all that here in... we'll get all into that. I'm getting ahead of myself. But let's go ahead and start with the very first one. All the main games that came out for the Sony consoles were developed by Santa Monica Studios. The first God of War released on March 22nd, 2005 for the PlayStation 2. And basically the storyline goes that after striking a deal with Ares, the God of War, to save his life after losing a major battle, Kratos becomes a servant to the gods with godlike powers and weapons. The other gods task him with finding Pandora's box in order to stop Ares from running amok and to finally kill him, because Ares has nefarious plans other than just, you know, simply helping out Kratos to win his battle, because Kratos is so bloodthirsty and so glory-seeking that he would be willing to do anything, no matter the price. And Ares takes, the God of War takes advantage of this and sees how much of a warrior he could be for him, and so grants him the power, and it with the confidence of having Kratos as his human weapon, he starts to terrorize the rest of the world, and eventually starts to ransack Athens, the town of worships Athena. And so the other gods say, "Yo, Kratos, you need to find Pandora's box and get rid of this guy." The final battle of it all is you are actually fighting and defeating Ares, and the word for that is the ascension to Mount Olympus to become the new God of War. Athena says, "Thank you. We can never repay you for what you've done. The throne to the God of War is now empty. Go ahead and take your seat." Now, this isn't originally why Kratos had agreed to it. Throughout one of his rampages, Kratos accidentally kills his wife and daughter. And this is done by some trickery of Eris. And this is what makes... This is one of the things that makes Kratos agree with the rest of the gods to try and break his blood oath and, you know, go after and try to kill Ares, because Ares tricked him. And Ares even came out and said it, and he was like, see, now you have nothing of this world to hold you back, and now you can finally reach your true potential. And this is where Kratos becomes that grayish white, that ashen white skin color, because what happens is there's a priestess outside the temple that he had killed his daughter and wife in. And so the priestess makes his daughter and wife's ashes adhere to his skin, so that there will always be a constant reminder of what he did and how and why he did it. So that's where Kratos gets his white, you know, snow white or ashen white skin color, is from that. And that's where, like I said, that's where Kratos decides, yo, this blood pack, you know, after 10 years, I'm not feeling this anymore, fam, so let's go ahead and do it. It did receive a Metacritic score of 94 out of 100, and it won a fair amount of awards, such as Game of the Year, Outstanding Achievement in Original Musical Composition, Best Video Game Release in the Fantasy Genre, Music of the Year, Best Live Performance Recording, and Best Interactive Score. And then on top of all that, it was also nominated for Best Original Vocal Song and Best Original Soundtrack Album and Outstanding Performance by a Lead in a Drama. So it definitely took the gaming by storm in 2005, and it didn't take very long for Kratos to be a signature face, or, you know, a go-to mascot for the PlayStation family of consoles. Just two little quick fun facts. There are actually two toll-free numbers you can call to hear a recorded message from Kratos on the phone. If you finish God mode, you can dial 1-800-613-8840. And if you destroy the statue, all the statues in the throne room, you get another one that's 1-888-447-5594. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. Moving on to God of War 2, it was released on March 13th, 2007 for the PS2. And this one continues not directly after God of War 1, but it does continue a little bit after. Kratos is really relishing in his... And his god, he's super angry and super vengeful, and still just wants to, you know, he despises gods to the core. He thinks there's no use for them. He thinks they're petty and pathetic, and he just wants to do everything to, at the very least, be an annoyance, and to the at the most, just absolutely get rid of them. So he starts to send his Spartan army all over. And eventually he ends up in the town of Rhodes. And he is so close to destroying Rhodes. And, you know, Athena is like, you need to stop doing this. And Kratos says, who are you to tell me what and what not to do? And Athena said, if you don't stop, I can't protect you anymore. And Kratos goes, well, fine, that's all well and good. I don't need your protection. So Athena ends up bringing to life a giant statue. And Kratos is having a really hard time fighting it. And Zeus comes down from the sky and he says, yo, take this Blade of Olympus. It'll help you defeat this, you know, this monster, this statue. And Kratos goes, I don't need your help. I don't need it. You know, why are you trying to help me? And Zeus says, you know, I need to keep order, law and order on Mount Olympus. And you're putting a real big hindrance into this. And I just want you to hurry up and get this over with. So he convinces Kratos to put all of his godlike powers into this Blade of Olympus. And he uses that to kill the statue. However, this was all a muse, all a trick by Zeus to get all of his powers into that blade. And then Zeus turns around and kills Kratos with that blade. So he goes down into the underworld, goes down into Hades, and, you know... Of course, like, super pissed off now. Kratos is like, no, it's not going to end like this. And he gets up and he starts to look for the three sisters of fate. And he does this because if he kills the three sisters of fate, then he gets to travel back in time and kill Zeus right before Zeus kills Kratos. He almost succeeds in doing this, getting into the end game, jumping ahead a little bit. He almost succeeds in doing this, but right before he kills Zeus, Athena jumps in front of him, sacrifices herself to save Zeus, and of course Kratos is like, why? Everybody hates Zeus, and Athena pretty much says yes, but if Zeus dies, chaos will ensue. The world will absolutely change as you know it, nothing will be the same. And she was like, and oh yeah, Zeus is your father, so dropped that bomb on him and then died. So God of War 2 won a crap ton of awards as well. Best story and character, technical achievement, outstanding action and adventure game. It was nominated for supporting performance in a drama, best original score, best action and adventure game, and best use of audio. And one interesting thing was that the Wings of Icarus that you use to glide around and get to some hard to reach spots in God of War 2, that was actually supposed to be in God of War 1, but some of the coding issues, they couldn't quite get it right, and it kept freezing and drawing back on the performance and everything, so they ended up cutting it out of God of War 1, but they were able to put it in of God of War 2. So, moving on a little bit, God of War Betrayal. Now, this game, a lot of people don't know about this game. This game was released June 20th, 2007, and a lot of people don't know about this game because it was the only game that was released on a platform other than a PlayStation. This game was actually released on mobile, as in a mobile phone. Now, 2007, you can only imagine that's just when the iPhone was coming out. So it was really, you can look at it, it was really crude. It was a 2D side-scrolling beat 'em up, pretty much is all it was. It actually takes place between the events of Ghost of Sparta and God of War 2, and basically somebody is murdered. Kratos ends up getting blamed for it, so he goes on this just bloody rampage through Rhodes and Athens and everything, not only trying to clear his name, but also find the killer and take his revenge on him. Getting back into the Sony platforms, again, that was the first, last, and only game that was made on a platform other than a Sony platform. God of War Chains of Olympus. It was released on March 4, 2008 for the PlayStation Portable, the PSP, and it takes place during his 10 years of servitude to the gods. So this actually goes back a little bit to before God of War 2. The game opens up by Kratos halting an invasion by the Persians and finds out that the world has been plunged into darkness because Persephone has actually captured Helios, the sun god, and is planning to use Titan Atlas to destroy the world. So you see Kratos with godlike powers, but he is not a god yet. He's doing the bidding of all these other gods. And so, you go through there. It was pretty much the same game that was on the PlayStation consoles, but it was on the PSP. The graphics were good. There was still that quick time, melee where you had to mash the buttons at just the right second. It was still a hack and slash, with combos and everything of the like. And you're moving through the story, and Kratos eventually chains Atlas to the world to make him hold up the world for good. This game ended up winning Handheld Game of the Year, Outstanding Achievement in Digital Video, and Best Handheld Game. And like I said, this was the first game released for the PSP, and it was also re-released in 2011 as part of the God of War Origins collection for the PS3. So that ended up being really cool. God of War 3 came next on March 16, 2010. This was the first one released for the new PlayStation 3 generation consoles. Kratos is abandoned by the Titans, and with help from the spirit of Athena, he seeks out the Flame of Olympus to defeat Zeus. And using Pandora herself to squash the Flame of Olympus and open up Pandora's box, he ends up killing Zeus. And, after Athena's like, oh, great, thanks for helping me kill Zeus, and now I'm ready to take my spot as the patron of Olympus, and I need your help to do it. And Kratos is like, no, F off, fam. I was only here to kill Zeus. So he totally shuts her down on that request, and he just ends up disappearing. You know, that put that threw a lot of people for a loop, because it was a really big cliffhanger. I mean, he walks off the scene, and you never see him again until about 6 months later on November 2nd, God of War Ghost of Sparta releases for the PS3, and it's set between the events of the first game and God of War Betrayal. So this is where you find out some more about Kratos. Kratos actually sets out to find his origins, and basically that just boils down to him trying to find his mother and his brother. Deimos, which is Kratos' brother, was abducted by Thanatos because he was the marked man that would take down the gods. There was a prophecy that a marked mortal would be the one to take down the gods. So Thanatos thought he would jump ahead of the curve and take this guy out. He abducted him, sent him down to Hades, and Kratos ends up finding him and defeating some monsters in Hades to end up bringing him back. But unfortunately, it's too little too late, because they get into this giant fight with Thanatos, and in that fight Deimos actually ends up dying. So it was all for nothing. And of course, Kratos does what he does best, and he just murderizes Thanatos. But in remembrance and as a nod to his brother, he tattoos himself in the same manner that his brother was marked, therefore fulfilling the prophecy of being the true marked mortal. So that's where Kratos gets all of his red markings and his tattoos on his body, is he actually did that to himself. And in turn of him doing that to himself, he actually fulfilled a prophecy. So, God of War Ascension was released on March 12, 2013 for the PS3. This was the first and only game to release a multiplayer, and for good reason. Multiplayer does not work with the God of War franchise. They had it both cooperative and competitive gameplay. It ended up turning into just who could mash their buttons the fastest. That's really all it was. There was no strategy in the competitive part. There was really no strategy. It was just wave after wave of who could mash their buttons the fastest. So 6 months after killing his wife and child, he is imprisoned by the Three Furies for breaking his blood oath to Ares. And he learns from Orcos, the Oath Keeper, that the Furies and Ares plan to overthrow Mount Olympus. So Kratos ends up going on this giant quest, you know, to kill Ares and kill the Furies and keep them from getting Mount Olympus. So the franchise overall, up to this point, it kind of jumps around a little bit. It doesn't really go in chronological order, but when you play all of them, the story does all come together. Jump ahead 5 years to 2018, and on February 1st, a text-based game on Facebook Messenger serves as a prequel to the 2018 version of God of War, where it introduces you. It's called God of War: A Call from the Wilds, and this introduces you to Atreus. And it's a text-based game. It's super short. You could probably play it in like 2 hours, if it even takes that long. And it's just basically so that when you put in God of War 2018, it's not such a culture shock to see Atreus and see Kratos being a dad. So God of War 2018 was released on April 20th, 2018 for the PS4. God of War has always been a Sony exclusive. So the story takes place many, many, many years after God of War 3. And it also, this game is significant in other ways, because it does begin the second era of the God of War franchise. So the first era was, you know, all about Greek mythology, set in Greek time frames. You know, it was Spartan and Athens and the town of Rhodes and Hades and Zeus and all that. This one takes a turn and starts to go its own route. So it actually begins the second era of the franchise by being based in North mythology. Norse mythology instead of Greek, and it actually takes place in ancient Norway in the realm of Midgard. And like I said earlier, this game is where you're introduced to his son Atreus, who he fathered with his second wife Faye. And the game starts out, Kratos's wife passes away for some unbeknown reason, and her last dying wish is for Kratos and Atreus to spread her ashes from the highest mountain peak. So the two set out to spread her ashes. As you progress through the game, spoiler alert, if you haven't played this game, as you progress through the game, you find out that Atreus was supposed to be named Loki by his mother, and he is actually the bringer of the Ragnarok. And so you're battling through all these things, and all these people are trying to keep him from being a Ragnarok, and you kill the two brothers, and at one point you're carrying a head around, and it's just all an awesome game, beautiful game. But we're going to get into that on a third section, because that's actually what I'm going to be doing our game review on, is the God of War 2018. So one final quick note. This was the first installment where T.C. Carson is not the voice of Kratos, is in this game. And this game also won too many awards to name. It won 27 different awards and was nominated by 20 other ones. So, all in all, the God of War franchise has been hugely successful. It's been the standard bearer for PS4 many times. It's Kratos is one of the most recognizable mascots for the Sony PlayStation family, and I just don't see any way that the God of War franchise is going to be slowing down anytime soon. They've already said that with this new God of War, that this is not going to be the last time that we see Kratos and Atreus. So definitely looking forward to those games. We're going to pull back a little bit again for another 30-second ad, and then we will be right back. Hello everybody, and thanks for coming back after that ad. As I stated earlier, this week on the video game review, we are going to be looking at God of War for the PlayStation 4. So to start it all off, I'm just going to go ahead and read you the overall plot of things. I am getting this from Wikipedia. These are not my original words, but after doing some research, this is the best interpretation of the plot that I found, where it gets out everything that you guys need to hear if you haven't played it yet, or to refresh your memory if you have played it. So, many years have passed since Kratos took vengeance on the Olympian gods, and he now lives with his son Atreus in ancient Norway in the realm of Midgard. The game opens following the death of Kratos' second wife and Atreus' mother, Faye, whose last wish was for her ashes to be spread at the highest peak of the Nine Realms. Before starting their journey, Kratos is confronted by a mysterious man with godlike powers. After seemingly killing him, Kratos and Atreus begin their journey. Reaching the Lake of the Nine, Kratos and Atreus encounter the friendly world serpent, Jormungandr, the last remaining giant. After running into impenetrable black mist, which can only be extinguished with the light of Alfheim, they receive aid from the Witch of the Woods to use the Bifrost to travel to Alfheim and secure the light. Upon vanquishing the mist and reaching Midgard's peak, they overhear a conversation between the mysterious man, revealed to be Baldur, his nephews Modi and Magni, and the imprisoned Mimir. After they leave, Kratos and Atreus confront Mimir, who reveals that their goal is in Jotunheim, but travel there has been blocked to keep out Odin and Thor. Mimir, however, knows another passage. He instructs Kratos to cut off his head and have it revived by the Witch of the Woods, revealed to be Freya. Kratos immediately distrusts her, but both Freya and Mimir warn him that he must tell Atreus about his true nature. Kratos, Atreus, and Mimir's head journey to collect needed components to open Jotunheim's portal when they are attacked by Modi and Magni. After Kratos kills Magni, Modi flees, but later returns and ambushes them. Atreus collapses, ill, which Mimir and Freya explain is a mental contradiction of a god believing himself to be mortal. She tells Kratos that he must retrieve the heart of the Keeper of the Bridge of... That's a lot of ofs. He must retrieve the heart of the Keeper of the Bridge of the Damned in Helheim, but his Leviathan axe is useless there. Kratos returns home to unearth his old weapons, the Blades of Chaos, and is haunted by Athena's spirit, which goads him about his past. After retrieving the heart, he has a haunting vision of Zeus. Atreus is cured, and Kratos tells him he is a god. Atreus becomes increasingly arrogant on their journey and murders a weakened Modi despite Kratos ordering him not to. At Midgard's peak, they are ambushed by Baldur, resulting in Jotunheim's portal being destroyed and the group falling into Helheim. Atreus makes amends with Kratos and they find out about Freya and Baldur's familial relationship. Returning to Midgard, Mimir realizes there is another way to reach Jotunheim, but it requires recovering his missing eye. After obtaining it from Jormungandr's belly, he had it inadvertently swallowed when he ate a statue of Thor. They are attacked by Baldur again, but Freya intervenes to protect her son. During the fight, Baldur is pierced by Atreus' mistletoe arrow, breaking Freya's spell on him. Baldur is defeated, and although Kratos gives him an opportunity to retreat, he attempts to strangle Freya instead, forcing Kratos to kill him. A grieving Freya swears revenge on Kratos and taunts him about hiding his true nature from Atreus. Kratos finally tells Atreus about his past and how he had killed his fellow Greek gods, including his father, Zeus. Atreus laments whether all that gods are good for is committing parricide. Kratos tells Atreus that they should both learn from their experience and not repeat the mistakes of their predecessors. A silent Freya leaves with Baldur's corpse, and Mimir hopefully suggests that she will eventually move on from the tragedy and learn Kratos did the right thing. In Jotunheim, they find a temple with a mural depicting their adventures, showing the giants had foreseen everything that would happen and vaguely foretold what was to come. In addition, they discover Fae was a giant who decided to stay behind in Midgard, making Atreus part giant, god, and mortal. Their fight with Baldur was shown, revealing he was after Fae the whole time, unaware that she was already deceased. It is also revealed that Atreus was named Loki by his mother. Wondering if Fae planned this in advance, Kratos and Atreus fulfill their promise and spread her ashes at the peak, overlooking a valley of giants' corpses. Afterwards, Kratos reveals to Atreus that his given name was also the name of a compassionate Spartan comrade. When they return to Midgard, Mimir warns them that the three-year-long Fimbulwinter has started, meaning Ragnarok is soon to follow, something that was not supposed to occur for another 100 years. In the game's secret ending, Kratos and Atreus return home in slumber. Atreus has a vision that at the end of Fimbulwinter, Thor will arrive at their home to confront them. So that is a very vanilla, very quick synopsis of the plot line. There is so much more, so many more minuscule details to the God of War game that I'd have to spend 2 or 3 hours just on that. But we don't have time to do that. So like I said, I wanted to find something that would really narrow it down and kickstart your memory or give you a brief overview if you've never played it. By the way, spoiler alerts. I mean, it's been a year now. I think for a video game, a year is long enough for spoilers. But to get into the game in itself, first of all, this game is running at 4K HDR. And it's beautiful. The way the lights reflect off the water, even the colors on the armor and the sword and Atreus's bow quiver, it's all so bright and vibrant. Colors that we haven't seen since the PSP God of War games. It really expands the palette, the color palette for this game. I mean, when you go to Freya's house, the turtle and everything and just her garden and the leaves blowing through the air and the water, trickling. It's just so visually and audibly appealing that, I mean, when I first came across it, I literally just sat there and turned in slow circles, kind of taking it all in. My surround sound was on. The picture was coming out at 4K, and it just all was just so visually and audibly beautiful and appealing and appetizing, and just it's awesome. The game is awesome to look at, and one of the ways that you look at it, kind of moving along here, one of the ways that it makes it different to look at is they finally abandoned that fixed camera that was really popular in the PS1 PS2 days, where they stick an invisible imaginary camera in the corner of the room and it's on you to navigate around. They finally abandoned that and they went with a third person camera view where it follows you around. I like that. I think us as video game players and video game publishers have outgrown the fixed camera thing. I think Resident Evil is really the only one that can get away with that now. And that's just for the nostalgia of it. But the way the new God of War implements the third person, it also adds to the combat. And the combat is a little different because you're not using the Blades of Chaos until about, you know, 3/4 of the way through the game. And it makes it feel like God of War, but obviously not the God of War that you played, you know, 10 years ago. There's no, you know, Kratos isn't jumping around and doing somersaults and spinning in circles and you know, whirling the Blades of Chaos on its long chains around and hitting multiple enemies at once. They really sucked in and narrowed down the combat for this version. You're mainly using the Leviathan Axe, which, you know, is an axe that you can augment with runes and stuff like that. And it's really more, instead of just seeing how many people you can hit at once and trying to get to that 100-hit, 200-hit combo because there's just swarms of enemies coming at you. And, you know, like I said, you're just doing all these tricks and stuff. It's more of a one-on-one, more brutal, more medieval-esque combat system where it's you and two or three different enemies, and a lot of times those enemies will have the advantage, right? Instead of just being cannon fodder to throw at Kratos to kind of move the storyline along, or to, you know, build up experience or gather red orbs or gather white orbs before the big boss, you actually feel like each battle means something, you know, because it's only, like I said, it's only one to three enemies that you're facing at any given time. And these enemies are smart, man. Like I said, they're not the cannon fodder. They're not just gonna come right at you and just, you know, like sheep to the slaughter. You know, you focus on one, and the other one or other two is coming around to flank you from behind. And you know, and Atreus is trying to do what he can. You have the ability to tell Atreus to shoot his bow at one or the other, you know, one of the monsters to distract him. And Atreus really holds his own in the combat. You can upgrade his bow, upgrade his quiver, you know, upgrade his skills and stuff, so that, you know, you're not just babysitting him the whole game. From start to finish, he really is a key player in the plot line, both in the story and in helping you in battle. You know, there's been a couple times where I've been on my last nerve, you know, last bit of health. I have Atreus pop three arrows into a guy, you know, to give me some time to heal up or some time to, you know, initiate my rage or something. And next thing I know, Atreus is going a step forward and choking him out with his bow, or, you know, doing some kind of crazy drop kick or something. So I do appreciate that fact that Atreus is just not there to be babysat and to give me little quippy one-liners. He is actually an integral part of the game, you know. So in the combat, you know, going back to the combat, like I said, it's very methodical and it's very brutal. It's not that quick, action-packed, fast-paced combat, you know, where you're swinging the Blades of Chaos, you know, 720 degrees and you're hitting 15 different enemies. First of all, there's not even 15 different enemies on the screen at once, as far as I can remember. And second of all, those enemies that are on the screen, they're working with each other against you to flank you, you know. And because it's a third person camera, if somebody gets behind you, there's a little arrow that pops up on your screen that tells you, you know, if somebody's attacking you, if somebody's setting up to attack you or whatever, so that you can, you know, quick turn. That's what it's called in the game. You can hit the button to quick turn and get a hold of them. Blocking becomes very important as well, especially when you get into the Rift Tears and you figure out that, you know, you might have accidentally opened a rift with somebody, with some monsters that are way higher level than you. You know, blocking and dodging, it's very important. I block and dodge a lot when I'm playing this game. So, moving on from that, I can't say enough about the combat. I do love it. I never was one for those hack and slash quick time I never was one for those hack and slash quick time games. I did play them from time to time. I did play all the God of Wars completely through for the storyline and for all that, but it was never really my first choice. But I do like also the direction that they took with Kratos. Kratos is a totally different character in this one than he was in the other ones. In the previous versions of God of War, we see this brash, loud, incredibly violent, very vengeful, always seeking revenge, you know, throwing the middle finger up at the gods and just doing whatever he can to be an annoyance, to either be an annoyance or, you know, be outright lethal to the gods. And here in this one, he still hates the gods. Don't get me wrong. He still hates himself because, you know, he is at the very least a demigod, but he's not so open about it. And I feel like we've caught Kratos at a very vulnerable time. You know, his second wife just died. His second child, his first son, is with him. Typical boy of an adolescent age, you know, not thinking he already knows everything, incredibly impatient, not listening to the teachings of his dad and stuff. So we see this super vulnerable, you know, super dad side of Kratos. And I'm not going to lie, at first that threw me off. I wasn't really expecting that. But I found it did not take me long at all to grow into this and to get used to this particular Kratos. And as the game played, I just fell in love with this particular Kratos more and more. I loved how he would teach his son different things like hunting and cutting and not losing his gear and you know, all those other things. And the little cutscenes were, you know, multiple times where Kratos acts like he's going to reach up and touch Atreus's shoulder, you know, like dads do, and then he always pulls away right at the last minute, and it's just tugging at my heartstrings every time I see that, both as a dad and as a son and as a video game player. You know, I'm like, come on, man, just reach out and let him know, like, it's all cool. But throughout the whole time, Kratos is also hiding a lot from Atreus. You know, he keeps his braziers on his wrist to cover up the chains that are, you know, that are still seared, you know, the scars and everything that are still seared and showing on his wrist. Because he doesn't want, as much as he's wanting Atreus to grow up and to survive on his own, he's also wanting him to stay as innocent as possible. And he doesn't want Atreus to know what he's done in his past life and where he's came from and the fact that he is a god. And Kratos goes through great pains to, you know, to ensure that this happens, you know, telling two or three other characters in the story, you know, like, keep your mouth shut. It's mine to tell, and I'm not ready to tell it to him yet. Until finally he has no choice. You know, Atreus grows sick, you know, and Freya, the Witch of the Woods, says, listen, the only way he's going to quit getting sick is if you tell him his true nature, because what is happening is that, in his mind, there's an unknown battle between a god and a mortal happening between him, and that's what's making him sick. So you gotta tell him. And then it's kind of expected what happens when he tells Atreus. You know, Atreus gets super cocky, super prideful, and even more impatient than he already was, to the point where he actually kills one of the brothers. And Kratos, you know, it was like, hey, I told you not to kill him. You know, when this battle started, I said only kill when I tell you to. And Atreus is, you know, like, well, what's it matter? Nobody liked him anyway. And then Kratos has to explain to him the consequences of killing a god, even a small one, even a petty one that nobody likes. So eventually they all, you know, everything is fine. Atreus and Kratos make up and stuff. But I also like what they did. Moving on a little bit over to the gear, I also like what they did with the gear as far as being able to upgrade it. It doesn't overwhelm you with everything that can be upgraded, you know, but you can build and upgrade your armor, your Leviathan axe. You know, you can put runes in it, you can put different handles on the axe, you know, you can put tomes and stuff on your armor, and so there's enough there to satisfy the appetite of, you know, being a gear hunter, of being a gear quester. but at the same time doesn't overwhelm and take away from the game. Like, that's not the point of the game. There are plenty of games out there that are built around that premise. That is the goal of the game, aka looter shooters. But this is not one of them. It doesn't let it take over. I mean, shoot, on Atreus, there's only three things that you can buy, upgrade, or craft for him. That's his bow, his quiver, and his garb. And that's it. And that's fine. That's the way it should be for this type of story. The new characters that came into the game are super funny. I fell in love with Brock immediately, the dwarf caravan guy. He's really quirky, you know, and I love his mannerisms and his one-liners and stuff. So he's really funny. Mimir is, I mean, goodness, it's a head that's strapped to your hip. How can you not fall in love, and how can you not chuckle at that thing? So Freya, I thought, was beautifully rendered and beautifully well done. And just the way they incorporated her into the storyline is awesome. So all in all, I give this game, I would say, I'm usually pretty charitable with my scores, but I mean, I would say honestly, this game deserves a 10 out of 10. I really do think that it is a 10 out of 10 game. It won Game of the Year, so obviously people agree with me. I honestly cannot think. You know, the longer I think, the longer I can't come up with anything that this game is missing, or that this game needs to do better, or this game needs to do less of. I really can't. Listeners, please, if you disagree, you know, DM me, email me, call or text me, and we will have this discussion, because I'd be curious to know out there who thinks that this game is missing something. And you know, show me something that this game is missing, or show me something that this game is doing wrong, and I'll show you a reason why you're just particularly not a God of War fan. So, with that being said, it's time to go ahead and end this episode. Again, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at The Noasis, TheNoasis. You can find us on Twitter at The Noasis, and then the number 1. You can find us on Snapchat at The Noasis. You can email us at usmcjoe1.com. And you can call or text at 304-834-8464. Please don't forget to go over and check out the sister podcast, The Noasis Weekly. We do a podcast every week on, you know, just overall nerd news. We do a little bit of nerd history, and we talk a little bit about the store, the particular store news. Go ahead and check us out. Don't forget about the art project that the Noasis, the store, is throwing to have a new logo for the Noasis Weekly podcast. Go ahead and run over to the Facebook site to check that out. So I appreciate all you video game nerds hanging out with me and talking with me. It's time for dinner, it's time for some beer, and it's time to love on my dogs. So thank you guys. Here's hoping you get that extra life.